If it pleases the court, my name is John Springer, and Lloyd Kordick and I represent the appellant, Margaret Dyna. Mr. Kordick is ill and can't be here today, and if he were, he'd be making this argument himself, but in his absence, I'll do the best I can. I'd like to go straight to the policy language to begin with, because it's the language of the insurance contract that controls what State Farm is obligated to do with respect to the payment of underinsured motorist benefits. The policy language is controlling, and therefore this really is a contract case. So we have to look at the language of the contract. The insurance contract in the underinsured motorist coverage provision states that State Farm will pay the amount of compensatory damages that the insured is entitled to collect from the underinsured driver. With respect to determining how much State Farm is obligated to pay, there's another section of the policy called the deciding fault and amount section that provides that if there's agreement that the other driver was at fault, then the parties must agree to the amount of compensatory damages that the insured is entitled to collect from the other driver. The policy does not say that the parties have to agree to the total amount of damages that the insured is demanding. The policy just says that they must agree to an amount, and that amount can be less than the insured's demand. It's our contention that in this case, State Farm and the insurer did agree on an amount of damages. It was less than the insured's demand, but they nevertheless agreed on an amount, and State Farm is obligated to pay that amount promptly.
And when was that agreement made?
The agreement was made at the time that State Farm prepared its evaluation of the claim, called a Level 2 report. And that Level 2 report was prepared by a claim representative and reviewed in the chain of command review process within the company at several different levels. And when that review was complete, which was around December the 13th of 2010, at that time, State Farm, I believe, was obligated to promptly pay that amount because the insured, although not expressly agreeing that she was entitled to this amount, implicitly agreed because the report that State Farm prepared calculated the amount of damages that the insured was entitled to collect from the other driver on a low range and high range basis.
So what was Ms. Dina's implicit agreement? What in the record do we see her implicit agreement?
I'm sorry, Judge, I didn't hear.
Oh, when you said if not an express agreement, you said that Ms. Dina made an implicit agreement.
Yes.
Okay, so I was just asking where in the record is that, and when was that?
Well, she would have implicitly agreed that she was entitled to the low range amount. She would have implicitly agreed that. It wasn't an express agreement, but it was an implicit agreement because State Farm had determined that she was entitled to at least a certain minimum amount. And although she was demanding more than that, she implicitly agreed to that lower amount. That's our position, that
okay.
It was an implicit, not an express agreement. And
Mr. Springer, let me just follow up quickly. Did she didn't ever request that they advance that amount, did she?
No.
Okay, so hypothetically, if State Farm sent that amount on its own determination, she cashed the check, doesn't that leave them open for a bad faith claim later on that they didn't pay more than that amount?
Well, she didn't demand that lesser amount. She was always demanding the policy limits.
No, I understand that, but it seems like you're putting the burden on State Farm to pay an amount that she didn't request and she didn't explicitly accept. And if they had done that, that leaves them open for some other claim that they hadn't paid the full amount she was demanding. So I'm trying to figure out how this works in Ms. Dina's mind. How is this supposed to work for State Farm?
Well, it's our position that they had a contractual duty to pay the amount that they had determined was the minimum amount that she was due. They had that contractual obligation to pay that because the policy says that if the company and the insured agree, then that's the amount that would be paid. State Farm agreed. The two sides never agreed to the total amount, but they certainly agreed to this lesser amount. State Farm agreed that she was owed that amount, and she implicitly agreed. Therefore, the contractual obligation arose that compelled State Farm to pay that lesser amount and then negotiate with her about the balance of her claim.
Mr. Springer, it seems to me that we got a time issue here because at the time the negotiations were going on, your client was constantly saying, I want the policy limits, and State Farm was saying no. How could there be an implicit agreement to pay a particular sum that she didn't even know about? In other words, she gets an offer that's less than policy limits, and the offer is to settle the entire case, right?
The offer was a settlement offer, yes.
Right. And so she never had the option, and she never knew that she had the option, under your theory, that State Farm knew what was owed, so to speak. She never had the knowledge to say, give me the amount that you're offering, but I won't take that in full satisfaction. I'll simply take that as a down payment.
That's absolutely correct. She did not know that. I did not know that as a representative. But we implicitly agreed that she was entitled to at least the low range amount.
So that would mean
I emphasize implicit.
So that would mean that in any type of bad faith situation, when an offer is being made, an insured, under your theory, could come back and say, I have an offer from you for $100,000 on a $500,000 limit policy. I'll take the $100,000, but I'm not going to sign a release, and I'm going to continue to press my claim. And that the carrier would then be in bad faith if indeed it had valued the claim perhaps even a little bit more than that, but was offering less?
Well, Judge, I don't know about the bad faith aspect of this. This is not a bad faith case.
Well, it's a statutory case. I'm sorry.
It's a statutory case.
Right.
And we're not alleging bad faith, and we do not believe State Farm acted in bad faith. In fact, they prepared this evaluation skillfully, competently, diligently, did a wonderful job, and came up with an amount that she owed.
Okay, I misspoke. But the language is unreasonable delay.
Yes.
And my question then would be, is it always an unreasonable delay for an insurance carrier to make an offer that they know is below what they might ultimately be required to pay?
Our position is not based or bottomed on the offer that was made. Whether there was an offer or no offer, whether it was accepted or not accepted, is irrelevant in this case. State Farm had an obligation to pay the amount they determined was owed to her at the moment that they reached that determination, not that very instant, but promptly after that. The fact that they made an offer is in this case is just immaterial. It doesn't mean anything. What is controlling and what is significant is that they determined the amount that was owed and didn't properly pay it.
Well, even if they hadn't made an offer, let's assume they evaluated internally.
Yes.
At $100,000. No demand has ever been made by anyone for payment, except notification that there might be a claim. Is it your position then, under those circumstances, it has an obligation to come forward and make a payment, regardless of whether it's intended to be a payment in full satisfaction or not?
Yes. That's our position.
So every time an insured has a claim, if the carrier evaluates it internally and says, we owe something, they should make that payment voluntarily?
Yes, because they're contractually obligated to do it. This is a first-party claimant. She's paid a premium. She made a deal with the insurance company. If she gets run into by an underinsured driver, they'll pay her. And the policy does not condition their obligation to pay on her accepting their settlement offer or there being a final settlement or a judgment or anything. They're contractually obligated to pay what they determine is owed to her, because she is implicitly agreeing that she's owed at least that much and perhaps more. The policy provides that when the parties come to an agreement, then this amount must be paid. The purpose of the statute that we're considering here today, 10.3.11.15, is designed to cure the very mischief that occurs when an insurance company withholds amounts that are due to the insured to gain settlement leverage. Because they have an awful lot of settlement leverage when they say, we'll pay you this amount, but only if you agree to accept this and no more. They ought to pay what they owe and then negotiate the balance of the demand. But they didn't do that in this case. And the statute provides that when benefits are owed, the carrier is under an obligation to pay, and failure to do so is unreasonable unless the insurance company has a reasonable basis for not paying. And in this case, they had no reasonable basis. The only reason they didn't pay her is that they wanted to negotiate a final settlement.
Well, Mr. Springer, isn't it in fact true based on the record that they were waiting for additional information about her lost compensation claim that had not been provided?
No. They made a determination that she was owed a certain amount in the first level two report and didn't pay. Later they got additional information that I provided them that her injuries were more serious than at first contemplated. And so they prepared another level two report. And then they increased the low range amount and the high range amount as well. But they didn't pay either of these two amounts. They should have paid the first amount, and they definitely should have paid the second amount once they determined that that's what is owed. This is a first party claim. The insured has paid a premium for this coverage. She's entitled to have the carrier pay what is owed to her. And then, if the parties disagree about the full amount of her demand, that can be negotiated and or litigated. If State Farm's position in this case is correct, that it didn't have any obligation to pay her a dime until there was a final settlement, then this statute is rendered completely meaningless. Because what the statute is trying to do is force insurance companies in first-party claims to pay the amount that they determine it is owed, and then negotiate or litigate the balance, which is true of any debtor-creditor situation. If somebody comes to me and says, you owe me $100, and I say, no, I don't owe you $100, I owe you $50. Creditor says, well, pay 50. And I said, no, I won't pay you a dime until you agree that all I owe is 50. I should pay the amount that I owe, the $50 I admit I owe, and then negotiate or litigate the balance. And that's what State Farm is doing in this case. That's what all insurance companies are doing. That's why the statute was enacted, to force carriers to pay the amount that they determine is owed and then litigate the balance. Now, these level two reports that I'm speaking of clearly were designed to determine the amount that was owed. And two of State Farm's own employees testified on deposition to that, and the trial court was wrong in granting summary judgment that was contrary to their testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, may it please the court. My name is Thomas Seaman. I practice with the law firm of Seaman and Chambers, and we represent State Farm in this appeal. I would submit to the court that the argument or the position being taken in this appeal by appellant, which urges the court to interpret both the State Farm insurance contract and also the statute, which is 10-3-11-15, in a way that appellant is urging would literally wreak havoc on the evaluation and settlement of uninsured, underinsured motorist claims. First of all, you have the plaintiff urging the court to find that the settlement authority that State Farm develops in evaluating a claim, which they evaluate using a level two report, that settlement authority, once it's established, equates to the amount that the insurance company owes on that claim. And the problem with that interpretation or urging that interpretation on this court is that settlement authority is not the same as what is owed on a claim. And that issue has been pretty well settled in Colorado by two cases. One was in 2002 in the Silva case, which was a third-party case. And then the second case more recently in 2012 extended Silva to first-party claims. And both cases are cited on pages 17 and 18 of the opening answer brief that we filed in this case. But the Supreme Court said that settlement authority is not the same as what is owed on a particular claim. Insurance companies establish settlement authority, as you might understand from the terminology, for the purpose of trying to resolve or settle the claim. It's not a concession of an amount owed, and settlement authority typically, as State Farm does, is established in a range, because this is not a science, or it's more of an art in terms of evaluating insurance claims. So you establish settlement authority between a low end and a high end, and then the task of the insurance company is to try to resolve the claim within that range of authority.
I have a question about that. Mr. Springer had stated that there was evidence in the record that the level two report was not just settlement authority, but was a determination of the benefits owed. And so is that conflicting evidence that would warrant this case to be able to proceed and survive summary judgment?
Your Honor, I disagree with his characterization of the, and what he's relying on in making that statement is deposition testimony, specifically testimony from one of the team managers, Brent Danielson. Two depositions were taken, Mr. Danielson and Mr. Arakaki. Mr. Arakaki is a more senior claim person than Mr. Danielson, but both of them, I think, testified essentially the same, and that is that the purpose of the level two reports is to obtain settlement authority so that the claim can then proceed to the next phase of trying to resolve a claim through negotiations. And Mr. Danielson made it clear in his deposition testimony that that was the goal or objective of establishing that settlement authority, was to try to negotiate a settlement within that range of authority. But it was never testified to in deposition that State Farm, by establishing a range of value, was conceding that the claim was worth at least the low end of that value and that they should go ahead and simply pay that. So that if you look at Silva and now the Sunahara case was just decided by the Supreme Court and extending Silva to first party claims, the settlement authority is not the equivalent of the of what is owed. Plaintiff's other argument, which I would submit to this court, is equally has a potential of wreaking havoc on evaluation and settlement of these first party claims for UM/UIM benefits, is that once that settlement evaluation is done, once that evaluation range of authority is established, that the insurance company then, by definition under the 10-3-11-15 statute is unreasonably delaying payment of benefits that are owed as soon as they establish the low end of their evaluation. And Mr. Springer's mind or his argument is that once that evaluation is done, State Farm or any insurance carrier ought to just write a check for the low end of that evaluation and then proceed to try to evaluate or try to negotiate a full settlement above that. And that's simply not what the way it works in terms of evaluating and then attempting to settle claims for uninsured, underinsured motorist benefits.
Mr. Seaman, can I ask you a question? It seems to me there's a two-pronged approach here that plaintiff is taking. It's one that you accurately articulated that when you owe something, you ought to pay it immediately as opposed to waiting for a settlement. But the second argument that I think I see running throughout this is the assertion that State Farm has a policy saying we are committed to pay what we owe. That's their, not their policy language, but their general overarching philosophy, if you will. And that Mr. Danielson said we were determining what we owed to the plaintiff here, and he admitted, I think, in his deposition, that was the purpose of a level two report.
And I think I don't agree that he admitted that in his deposition. And I think that saying or slogan or call it what you will, while it's accurate, doesn't mean that once the evaluation is established in a range of it, that means that they pay the low end of that range because it's some sort of undisputed amount. Actually, what State Farm owes to its insured under the language of the policy, and Mr. Springer is urging the court to apply the policy language, and I think the court should as well. It is a contract action. Policy says that what is owed in uninsured motorist or underinsured motorist benefits is determined one of two ways, and that was testified to by Mr. Arakaki in his deposition. And the two ways of establishing that are either by agreement between State Farm and its insured, and that's in the policy language that says deciding fault amount. Pure fault is not an issue, but deciding amount is determined either by agreement by State Farm or between State Farm and its insured, or absent an agreement, then the case is litigated, the claim is litigated either in front of a court or a jury. Here, there was never any agreement reached with regard to the amount owed in damages. So there was not any determination or establishment of an amount of benefits owed. If you look back at the 10-3-11-15 statute and the way the legislature worded that statute, it says that the first party insurer can be held liable for twice the covered benefit plus attorney's fees if there is a delay in payment of a claim for benefits owed. And the benefits owed language, I think, is the part of that statute that creates a lot of confusion, particularly in uninsured, underinsured motorist claims. We pointed out in our brief that there are first-party claims where the benefits owed are pretty much determined by the type of contract. A health insurance contract would be one example where you have an incurred bill submitted to a health insurance carrier. It's a liquidated sum. Life insurance contract would be another one where there's a death benefit that's defined in the policy and you know what the amount owed is, the benefits owed based on the contract. 10-4-609 establishes uninsured, underinsured motorist coverage. It's optional coverage, but it has to be offered. But then the amount of the benefit is determined by the amount of damages, compensatory damages that would be recoverable from the at-fault tortfeasor who was either uninsured or underinsured. And that's where the problem lies in these cases, because you've got a damage amount that is made up of three components: economic, non-economic, and physical impairment or permanent disfigurement. So you have the same problem in terms of establishing the amount of benefits owed that you would in a third-party claim. So the policy language says we're going to decide the amount owed in one of two ways. Either there's going to be an agreement reached between the policyholder and the insurance company, or short of that, if there's no agreement, then the case is going to be litigated and a jury or a court will decide that. So we don't think there were benefits owed just because State Farm did an evaluation to try to reach that agreement. That was the purpose of the level two reports, was to establish a range of authority and then try to resolve the claim through agreement.
Tell me why Mr. Danielson's testimony doesn't create an issue of fact as to whether this was owed or not, because can't his testimony be read to say that State Farm did owe something?
I think that a reasonable approach to Mr. Danielson's testimony is to take that testimony as a whole. And that's what we try to point out in our opening answer brief, is that if you take Mr. Danielson's testimony as a whole and look at the entire body of that testimony, he's not indicating that by creating a range of value that State Farm is establishing a benefit or an amount of benefit that's owed on the low end of that range. Well, all they're trying to do is establish a range of value. What the Supreme Court and Silva and now in the Sunahara case call establishing settlement authority, that's the purpose of a level two report, is to obtain that settlement authority in a range for purposes of them trying to negotiate that agreement between the insured and the insurance company.
Well, I understand the taken as a whole argument, but we're on summary judgment here. We're not looking to determine the truth or veracity or make factual determinations here. My concern is that his testimony, just taking even little snippets out, why doesn't that create an issue of fact? Because a jury could very well side totally with you. I completely see that. But on summary judgment, we're supposed to decide if there's any genuine issue of material fact. And if what is owed is a material fact, how can we close the circle, if you will, by saying whether State Farm believed, or an officer or an employee of State Farm believed, something was owed, creates an issue of fact?
Well, other than the argument that I've already made, Your Honor, I don't know what else I can say to address that. I think that the analysis that was performed by the trial court in this case is whether or not reasonable minds could differ in determining whether or not State Farm unreasonably delayed uninsured or underinsured benefits that were owed to its insured. And the court, looking at all of the evidence, and the court trial court had before it all of the deposition testimony, both by Mr. Danielson and by Mr. Arakaki, concluded that a reasonable jury would not be able to decide that under those circumstances, even given that testimony, that a jury could find reasonably that State Farm had unreasonably delayed payment of the uninsured motorist benefit.
Isn't that a directed verdict kind of standard as opposed to any genuine issue of material fact? When you say no reasonable jury could conclude, that sounds like a motion for directed verdict, whereas we're looking at whether there's any genuine issue of material fact. So I understand your response. I guess I'm not expecting an answer unless you have something further on it.
I really don't, Your Honor. The other point that I wanted to make has to do with our cross appeal, and that is that the trial court, without any sort of explanation or elaboration at all, in its order indicated that each party would pay its own costs and attorney's fees. We've cited the recent case that's In Re Marriage of Bookbinder. I think at a minimum, I agree that a trial court has discretion to direct something other than an award of cost, but I think the Bookbinder case indicates that because of the language both in 54D and in the cost statute, that the court has to make some finding or statement as to a basis for denying State Farm an award of cost when it is the prevailing party, as it is in this case. So we're asking that the court enter an order of limited remand to the trial court for purposes of that determination or factual determination by the court as to why costs would not be awarded to State Farm as the prevailing party in this case. Unless you have additional questions, I don't think I have any additional argument. Thank you, Judge Lichtenstein, for getting out of your bed to come here today.
Thank you, counsel. If I'm not mistaken, Mr. Springer, you're out of time.
I thought I had a few seconds left.
Bailiff, does Mr. We're all done? All right. Gentlemen, the case will stand submitted. We appreciate your arguments this afternoon. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. As soon as counsel can be prepared and ready to present on People versus Samal, we'll hear that.